Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. It's freaking hot outside. So I don't have my coat on. I hope you don't mind. I did put on a tie and I've got my pens. So you can ask me which pens they are. This is just a Bic. I don't know why you'd want to know about that, but this is Fowler Gun Room in Orange, California. They're not a paid sponsor, but I have done business there before. So now that you know about my pens, let's get into the material. The material today is the admin law connection with constitutional law. But before we get to that, I actually have a spiritual reflection for us. And I wanted to pull it up. Spiritual reflection from Todd Hunter, who you don't maybe know who he is. He just retired as the bishop of our bishop. And he has this really interesting quotation or story about his interaction with Dallas Willard. And so I wanted to just share this briefly with you before we start. All right, I had to find the page real quick. I'm sharing my screen. Feel free to call me Sharon. We have this post right here. 16 years into my ministry, I had the joy of befriending Dallas Willard and gaining a new perspective on my life's work. Dallas said, "Your work is not God's work. You are God's work. God is calling, shaping, and creating a people. Your work is simply the context in through which you pursue discipleship to Jesus as God is shaping you into the person you will forever be." That was a lot for me to take in, says Todd. My work and relationships and hobbies were important, but occurring within a larger narrative with another goal? I had to ask, Dallas, what exactly do you mean? He said, Todd, nothing you do will last forever, but you are a never-ceasing spiritual being with an astonishing future serving God. Serving with God in the new heavens and the new earth, you are God's focus. Your work and the other elements of your life are the context in which you cooperate with God in the transformation of your heart, soul, mind, bodily strength, and will. As you focus your life that way, you are setting a trajectory for the kind of person you will eternally be in the perfections of the new heavens and the new earth. So reflect on that. Dallas Willard is my intellectual grandfather, as I've mentioned before. See the episode on mentoring that I did over the summer. It's one of the ones where I was in the backyard with the towel around me. You can see if you're on YouTube, you'll see it. So we continue in our swirly, twirly gumdrops of administrative law. Loper Bright. This is one of the most important issues in American politics. Not that, everybody's talking about it because it's a little hard. It's tough. Requires an attention span. This is Chief Justice Roberts' opinion for majority opinion for the court in Loper Bright, which overturned Chevron deference. And I think we're making some progress in our Chevron deference deep dive to understand these issues. And to understand them deeply and well. At least that's what we're going for here on the Republican Professor podcast. So thanks for joining me on this Tuesday, 2nd of September, 2025 years after Jesus. Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution assigns to the federal judiciary the responsibility and power to adjudicate cases and controversies, concrete disputes with consequences for the parties involved. We're in Roman numeral 2A on page 7, 603 of the U.S. Reports, Slip Opinion, 2024. Yes, it was just last year. Monumental. The framers appreciated that the laws judges would necessarily apply in resolving those disputes would not always be clear. Cognizant of the limits of human language and foresight, they anticipated that all new laws, though penned with the greatest technical skill and passed on the fullest and most mature deliberation, would more or less obscure and equivocal until their meaning was. Would be more or less obscure and equivocal until their meaning was settled by a series of particular discussions and adjudications. That's from Federalist 37. That Chief Justice Roberts is quoting. The framers also envisioned that the final interpretation of the laws would be the proper and peculiar province of the courts. Unlike the political branches, the courts would by design exercise neither force nor will, but merely judgment. To ensure the steady, upright, and impartial administration of the laws, the framers structured the Constitution to allow judges to exercise that judgment independent of influence from the political branches. This court embraced the framers' understanding of the judicial function early on. In the foundational decision of Marbury versus Madison, Chief Justice Marshall famously declared that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. We're on page 8 now. In the following decades, the court understood interpreting the laws in the last resort to be a solemn duty of the judiciary. When the meaning of a statute was at issue, the judicial role was to interpret the act of Congress in order to ascertain the rights of the parties. The court also recognized from the outset, though, that exercising independent judgment often included, according due respect to the executive branch interpretations of federal statutes. I'm going to take a drink of green tea. Trying to keep my energy up today because today is the first day back from summer vacation for CBS. Community Bible Study. It's meeting in Calvary Chapel, Old Town, which is in Orange. And we got a barbecue. It's a men's group. That means you have to know the difference between a man and a woman, which is no problem for the particularly people that go to these this involvement here. And so we don't really bring politics into it, but it's pretty clear almost everybody's a Republican. So there's no confusion about men and women, at least in our group, or pretended confusion. I don't think people really are confused. I think it's all just a bunch of trying to pretend you're moral or something. It's some weird game that people have. But anyway, I'm excited to go back. We're doing the Psalms this year. It's on Tuesday nights, so I got to keep my energy up. So let's get through this, okay? Come on. Let's do this. For example, in Edwards Lessee versus Darby, ooh, the court explained that in the construction of a doubtful and ambiguous law, the contemporaneous construction of those who were called upon to act under the law and were appointed to carry its provisions into effect is entitled to very great respect. Such respect was thought especially warranted when an executive branch interpretation was issued roughly contemporaneously with the enactment of the statute and remained consistent over time. That's because the long-standing practice of the government, like any interpretive aid, can inform a court's determination of what the law is. The court also gave the most respectful consideration to executive branch interpretations simply because the officers concerned were usually able men and masters of the subject who were not infrequently the draftsmen of the laws they were afterwards called upon to interpret. Page 9 at the top. Respect, though, was just that. The views of the executive branch could inform the judgment of the judiciary, but did not supersede it. Whatever respect an executive branch interpretation was due, a judge certainly would not be bound to adopt the construction given by the head of a department. Otherwise, judicial judgment would not be independent at all, as Justice Story put it. In cases where a court's own judgment differed from that of other high functionaries, the court was not at liberty to surrender or waive it. Now we're in B, Roman numeral 2, B. How are you doing? You getting it? You see all the separation of powers discussion between the judiciary and the executive as it comes to interpreting the law, saying what the law is, right? And then how that differs from Congress. This is a separation of powers podcast, baby. That's a separation of powers point. What I'm trying to tell you is that the Republicans, when they overturned Chevron last year, they had separation of powers in mind. You like my tie? I got a green tie with blue dots. What I like about this is the fact that green and blue go so well together, and I don't think I ever really fully realized that until I saw this tie. And then I've got a light green, like a lime green shirt on, and that's because it's still summer. It feels like it's getting into fall, but it's still summer. Green is the color of summer. I'm going to start bringing my fall colors out pretty soon, but I feel like I want to wear more green. I have a brownish green jacket. I think if you saw it, you'd say it's brown, but if you look closely, there's little bits of green in it. And so I wear that jacket when I wear this tie combo. And it's a little bit too warm for the jacket right now. The sun is really hitting the wall here and this time of day. And so we're going to get back to Loper Bright here. We're in B. The New Deal ushered in a rapid expansion of the administrative process, but as new agencies with new powers proliferated, the court continued to adhere to the traditional understanding that questions of law were for courts to decide, exercising independent judgment. During this period, the court often treated agency determinations of fact as binding on the courts, provided that there was evidence to support the findings. When the legislature itself acts within the broad field of legislative discretion, the court reasoned, its determinations are conclusive. Congress could therefore appoint an agency to act within that sphere of legislative authority and endow the agent with power to make findings of fact, which are conclusive, provided the requirements of due process, which are specially applicable to such an agency, are met, as in according to a fair hearing and acting upon evidence and not arbitrarily. Now, he's doing a lot of quoting, but I'm not going to tell you every single place he quotes because I want this to go smoothly. But the court did not extend similar deference to agency resolution of questions of law. Okay, we're at the top of page 10. It instead made clear repeatedly that the interpretation of the meaning of statutes as applied to justiciable controversies was exclusively a judicial function. The court understood, in the words of Justice Brandeis, that the supremacy of law demands that there shall be an opportunity to have some court decide whether an erroneous rule of law was applied. It also continued to note, as it long had, that the informed judgment of the executive branch, especially in the form of an interpretation issued contemporaneously with the enactment of a statute, could be entitled to great weight. Perhaps most notably along these lines, in Skidmore versus Swift, 1944, the court d explained that the interpretations and opinions of the a relative agency made in pursuance of official duty and based upon specialized experience constitute a body of experience and informed judgment to which the courts and litigants could properly resort for guidance, even on legal questions. The weight of such a judgment in a particular case, the court observed, would depend upon the thoroughness evident in its consideration, the validity of its reasoning, its consistency with earlier and later pronouncements, and all those factors which give it power to persuade, if lacking power to control. Well, that's a very interesting quotation right there. What stands out to me right here about this quotation is the issue of power to persuade if lacking power to control. Remember, the judicial branch does not have the power of the sword. The executive branch does. Okay? Its power ultimately comes down to persuasion. That's why we're focusing on the judicial branch for a lot of our discussion of constitutional law. We don't have to do that, but I think educationally it's easier because judges usually feel like they have to abide by a norm which says something like, for judicial action, you must give adequate reasoning for it. Not the other branches don't have that norm all the time, at least as strongly. That's why we have judicial opinions. You have a decision, but then there's opinion backing up the decision. And so, from an educational perspective, if you're interested in the giving of reasons and the strength of persuasion, well, then that's great educational fodder. Congress doesn't always speak with a clear voice about why it's doing what it's doing. There's a cacophony involved, and that's much more difficult to teach. And there's an educative process there, but it's very difficult to wade through. And I think structurally, it's just hard to figure out why Congress did something, because you're talking about 435 people plus 100, 535 people. So you really have 535 reasons, and even then, they're not usually spelled out. And there's all sorts of shenanigans involved that obscure the reality of it. So, it's easier with the executive branch in the sense that you have the president and you have agency and department heads, and they oftentimes comment about why they do things, but sometimes they don't even tell you either themselves, because sometimes it might be classified. And sometimes for political reasons, they may not want to tell you why they did something. You might not know until later when you see the diaries or the presidential papers or whatever. And that might be way past when you're studying it. So The judiciary is the most helpful for constitutional legal studies, I think. And it's because of this feeling that it has the power to persuade, even if lacking control. On occasion, to be sure, we're going back to the decision here. The court applied deferential review upon concluding that a particular statute empowered an agency to decide how a broad statutory term applied to specific facts found by the agency. For example, in Gray versus Powell, 1941, the court deferred to an administrative conclusion that a coal-burning railroad that had arrangements with several coal mines was not a coal producer under the Bituminous Coal Act of 1937. We're on page 11 at the top. Congress had specifically granted the agency the authority to make that determination. The court thus reasoned that whereas here a determination has been left to an administrative body, this delegation will be respected and the administrative conclusion left untouched, so long as the agency's decision constituted a sensible exercise of judgment. Similarly, in NLRB versus Hearst Publications, 1944, the court deferred to the determination that the National Labor Relations Board, the determination of the National Labor Relations Board that newsboys were employees within the meaning of the National Labor Relations Act. The act had, in the court's judgment, assigned primarily to the board the task of marking a definitive limitation around the term employee. The court accordingly viewed its own role as limited to assessing whether the board's determination had a warrant in the record and a reasonable basis in law. Such a deferential review, though, was when he says deferential review, he means the court takes it easy on the executive branch. In other words, the standard is, are you contradicting yourself? Are you a total idiot, even if I disagree with you? If you're not a total idiot, even if we disagree with you, we'll let it fly. That's called deferential review. Such deferential review, though, was cabined to fact-bound determinations like those at issue in Gray and Hearst. Neither Gray nor Hearst purported to refashion the long-standing judicial approach to questions of law. Are you catching this? This is making sense. You got a distinction between fact-bound issues and issues about the law, what the law says. So keep that distinction in mind. Keep going. In Gray, after deferring to the agency's determination that a particular entity was not a producer of coal, the court went on to discern, based on its own reading of the text, whether another statutory term, other disposal of coal, encompassed a transaction lacking a transfer of title. The court evidently perceived no basis for deference to the agency with respect to that pure legal question. And in Hearst, the court proclaimed that undoubtedly questions of statutory interpretation are for the courts to resolve, giving appropriate weight to the judgment of those whose special duty it is to administer the questioned statute. At least with respect to questions it regarded as involving statutory interpretation. The court thus did not disturb the traditional rule. It merely thought that a different approach should apply where application of a statutory term was sufficiently intertwined with the agency's fact-finding. Page 12 at the top. We're in Loper Bright, 2024, Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion. In any event, the court was far from consistent in reviewing deferentially even such fact-bound statutory determinations. Often the court simply interpreted and applied the statute before it. And he's citing some scholarship here. I'm going to skip down. In one illustrative example, the court rejected the U.S. Price Administrator's determination that a particular warehouse was a public utility entitled to an exemption from the administrator's general maximum price regulation, despite the striking resemblance of that administrative determination to those that triggered deference in Gray and Hearst. The court declined to accept the administrator's view in deference to the administrative construction. That's 1944. The administrator's view, the court explained, had hardly seasoned or broadened into a settled administrative practice, and thus did not outweigh the considerations that the court had set forth as to the proper construction of the statute. Nothing in the New Deal era or before it thus resembled the deference rule the court would begin applying decades later to all varieties of agency interpretations of statutes. Okay, so what he just did was he basically said in the period of greatest administrative state growth in the 1900s, which was the New Deal, the first big splash of large government programs that we'd never seen before, of the likes that we've never seen before, that spawned by Democrats during the New Deal, that back then it was better than what we had coming up to Chevron and after Chevron in 1984. And that we really need to go back to something like that, where there's better respect for separation of powers. Now, he's not going to comment on the administrative state per se. He's just commenting on the separation of powers and the role of history, specifically looking at the New Deal era. But nothing in the New Deal era. Okay. Instead, just 5 years after Gray and two after Hearst, those New Deal era, World War II era decisions that he's talking about, Congress codified the opposite rule. The traditional understanding that courts must decide all relevant questions of law. We're on page 13 and we're in C now. Roman numeral two, letter C. I think that will do it today for the Republican Professor podcast. I've been your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. We're working our way through Chevron deference deep dive. We started last year. We're getting there. We're getting there. And I'm very proud of you for hanging in there. Stay tough. It's a 2 September 2025, years after Jesus. Stay cool. We'll talk to you later.